tomorrow he may be... She stopped. She had not told Anani about the tomb robbery, nor did she intend to. He cares only for his king, she finished. You do too, Mara. You want the king to be pharaoh. Mara nodded. As I say, I'm a fool. Why in Amun's name should I fret over who rules Egypt? There is always a pharaoh, just as there is always a Nile. But such a maid as I could live her a whole life without knowing which face it was beneath the double crown, or caring a fig if she did know. Hatshepsut, Thutmose, what does it matter? I've my own worries. She broke off, adding, The trouble is, it does matter. Perhaps it is because you know him now. Perhaps it is, said Mara slowly. Aye, and because I have watched him and talked to him, and seen him pacing up and down like a lion in a cage. Aye, he is a conqueror, my princess. Who else would have had the wit to stage that miracle, or go on plotting a revolution with spies all about him? Or spared a moment to be kind to a princess he does not want, said Anani with a smile. She meant the vase. Mara was suddenly very happy about the vase. Aye, he is kind, too. He is a great man. And you, she told herself a moment later, are becoming far more interested in him than is good for you. Take care, or you'll fall under his spell like Sheftu and throw your life and all your plans away. She got up angrily and padded over to the balustrade again, where she stood watching the last glow over the hills and curling her bare toes against the cool pavements of the roof. I'm a fool all the same, she remarked, as Anani came up beside her. Will Thutmose ever notice or remember that I served him? Asked! All pharaohs are alike. I know little of pharaohs, said Anani, but I have seen the queen, and I have seen the king, and they are not alike. Aye, but they are. Look yonder. Mara pointed westward, where Hatshepsut's graceful temple shimmered in the blue shadows under the cliff. Men died by hundreds in the quarries to cut those stones for her, and others sailed to the end of the world to bring back the little incense trees. I know, I have been told of it. Yet tomorrow, the king sends Sheftu, his nearest friend, on a journey far more terrible. Perhaps there is no one else he can trust. And perhaps Sheftu will never come back. More than perhaps. Then what good is he to the king or anyone else? Aye, there is a fool for you. To do that for any pharaoh. I told him so only last night. And what did he say? Mara's anger faded into puzzled wonder as she remembered what he had said. He spoke nonsense. He said, I do not do it for Pharaoh, I do it for Egypt. What does that mean? Pharaoh is Egypt. She shrugged. I didn't understand it then, nor do I now. I understand it, Mara. Mara looked at her curiously and found that her whole timid face was shining with eagerness, like a pale, round moon gleaming through the dark clouds of her hair. In the blue light of evening, she looked almost beautiful in her shawls and draperies. You understand? Repeated Mara slowly. Then tell me, what did he mean? Egypt is not Pharaoh, Mara. Nor is it this long green valley with its black mud that is so different from what I know. Egypt is neither the Nile nor the cities. Then what is it? You, Mara. I? And all the others, the people, all those you have told me of, and the fishermen yonder on the river, and the potters and carpenters and their like, coming out of all those buildings far over there in what you call the city of the dead, and their friends and their kin. Anani peered into Mara's face and shook her head sadly. Alas, that means nothing to you, does it? In your life, you have had neither friends nor kin.
Nor have I needed them, retorted Mara.
Pity, like honey, could become too sweet on the tongue. She half turned away from Anani, her elbows on the balustrade and her eyes, in spite of herself,
on the stream of tiny white-clad figures winding through the streets far over yonder, who had suddenly become not mere figures, but human beings, with friends and kin and homes to go to. "Nay, perhaps you have not needed them," said Inanni gently, "but many others do. I will tell you a little story. When my father was a young man, there came a great famine over Canaan, over all of Syria, and many flocks perished in the drought, and there were only a few who made harvest that year and had grain in their storehouses. And my father, who had been king for only a little while then, but who was very wise, called in these men and showed them the poor, starving in the streets. And then he bade them bring their grain to his storehouses and their flocks to his pastures, and they did so. And until the famine passed, rich and poor shared alike from the common store, which my father divided among them. They did not do it for my father, Mara, but that Canaan might live. And did it live? Aye, the enemy from the north swept down and conquered many nations that year, when all were weak from the famine. But in Canaan there were strong men to defend the cities. The white-clad stream had all but disappeared in the blue dusk, and the sky was a vault of purple. Mara sighed and turned away from the balustrade with a shrug. It is a touching story, my princess, if they spoke truth. But what has it to do with Egypt? We have no famine, nor can I imagine any rich noble I have met who would share so much as a grain of corn with those tomb workers yonder. Consider my well-beloved master. Hi, I can see him dividing his goods with his grooms and servants. Mara broke off, struck by a sudden unpleasant thought. Her last encounter with Lord Nahere had directly followed an audience with the king. If the Libyan came tonight. "My princess, let us go down now," she said hurriedly. "It grows dark, and I, too, have a story to invent. One so convincing it will pass for truth. Come, let us go down. I must think." "Very well, Mara," said Inanni softly. "We will go down." She was silent as they hurried down the stairs and along the hall. But at the door to her apartments she stopped, putting a gentle hand on Mara's arm. "Mara, I hope all goes well with you." "Do not fear for me, my princess. I'll think of something. Stay, I even have a talisman to protect me." Smiling, she plunged her hand into her sash and triumphantly produced the ring, which she slipped onto her finger. "It will bring good luck, provided I do not wear it in the wrong company," said Mara dryly. "And now I will tell you something, though I know not if it's wise to do so." She hesitated, then whispered rapidly, "The ring brought you luck today, as well as me. If all goes well, if all this we have talked of tonight comes to pass, and the king rules Egypt, then you need to stay here and be homesick no longer in this land you hate." "They will send me home?" whispered Inanni incredulously. "I have Sheftu's promise on it. There, do not look so, or everyone will guess what I have told you. It is only an if, you know. You must not hope too hard." "Mara, I will try not. Thank you, thank you." Inanni tried to say more, failed, and hiding the radiance of her face beneath one of her many shawls, hurried through the door and into her chambers. The Syrian women were still at their embroidering and chattering, but Inanni passed through their midst and went directly to her bedroom. "I'm glad I told her," thought Mara. "Very glad." Wrenching her mind back to her own affairs, she headed for her room. What was she going to tell that crocodile of a Nahere? She needed time to think. "Perhaps," she reflected as she pushed aside the tapestry that curtained her door, "I could accuse that spying little scribe of something or other. Say he was acting suspicious, friendly to the king." She grinned as she closed the door behind her and turned into the room. Pompous little donkey. He would not last long if... Her thoughts broke off with a jolt. Shadzar, the Libyan, was leaning stolidly against the far wall,
waiting for her. For a moment, she felt an overpowering desire to whirl around, dash back through the door, and seek safety in that crowd of Syrians until the last one went to bed. A well-developed instinct for self-preservation prevented her. If she betrayed the least sign of panic. She heard her own voice speaking coolly, almost indifferently. "You come very early."
"I come when I'm sent," grunted Shadzar. "Get a cloak."
"But I'm not ready yet. I came only to fetch the board for hounds and jackals. The Syrian expects me to entertain her until bedtime."
"That's none of my affair."
He pushed away from the wall and walked forward, while Mara cast about desperately for some other excuse to delay, to gain time. He scowled at her, switching his whip impatiently against his sandal.
"Make haste! Fetch a cloak!"
There was small use arguing with that restless whip and the look in that one eye, which had begun to gleam balefully in the Libyan's pale-skinned, brutal face. Mara found her cloak and flung it about her with trembling fingers. She would have to do her planning on the way. But there was no time to plan, no time to think. Before she could conquer her confusion, she was in the chariot, sweeping through the streets of western Thebes. The ride was as wild as before, but this time Mara wished it had lasted longer. In vain she struggled to make her brain function. As she stepped down into the dark courtyard beside her master's house, moved on reluctant feet through the little side door and into the hall. The same scent of wine and perfume drifted to her nostrils, the same faint echoes of merriment to her ears.
"Cease your dawdling,"
growled Shadzar, giving her a prod with the whip handle.
"Think you he wants to wait forever?"
An instant later, she stepped into the small tapestry-hung study, and the door closed behind her.
"Well,"
came the chilly voice of her master. Mara's hand closed convulsively over the ring. "Live forever, illustrious one," she heard herself saying. "May thy shadow seek the light. May thy—"
"Save your pleasantries for those who wish them,"
he cut in acidly.
"What news have you?"
"Honored one, I have the best of news. I was successful in preventing the king from sending away his attendants. As I promised you, every one of them was present during the interview." Nehere said nothing, merely settled himself in a chair and waited. Mara hurried on. "It was no small matter to convince my princess, I assure you. I coaxed and coaxed, and finally had to prod her a little. 'My princess,' I said to her, very severely, master. 'My princess. His Highness himself believes it better to allow these menials to be present during the audience. Come, they might suspect you are afraid of them.' 'Of course she is afraid of the master, but she does not like to admit it.' And that won the game."
It had indeed won the game, though not quite in the way Mara implied. It was the king, not Inanni, who had caught the significance of that phrase.
"They might suspect," he who had suddenly decided the attendant should stay in the room. Mara saw no reason, however, to mention these things to the granite-faced son of Set in the chair before her. Instead, she smiled as if expecting his praise, and helped herself to a sweetmeat from his golden bowl. "And so, you see, I shall have this trouble no more, and there'll be every chance to watch for that messenger."
"You have not found him yet?"
"I cannot be sure," she evaded. "However, I kept a watch on the scribe as you instructed me. He's of small use to you."
"How so?"
"The king knows him for an enemy. What chance have I to observe anything useful with his highness guarding every syllable, every motion?"
"I thought you said you would have every chance."
"With the scribe gone, yes. But while he is there..."
"Do I understand,"
said Nehere ominously,
"that you have come empty-handed again?"
She met his eyes and saw quite plainly that no evasion was going to work. Unless she produced some kind of information, and produced it at once, this man would sell her instantly, or do worse. Her mouth went dry with sudden fear.
She had nothing to tell him, save the truth. And if she told him that... A wild scheme darted into her mind. Could she tell him a scrap of truth? A mere scrap, convincing, yet not really dangerous? If she could control it... Nay, it was too reckless, a mere gamble.
Well,
said her master. She heard her own quick laugh, her voice speaking. Nay, I'm far from empty-handed, master. The wildest gamble. She must not think of it, with the stakes so high. But what of her own stakes in this game? In 15 minutes she could be back in her rags, dodging some new master's stick, tossed into oblivion like a handful of rubbish. Look after yourself, Mara. Nobody else will. She threw the dice. I have something, but I know not what to make of it. Perhaps you know that His Highness amuses himself by designing vases. Well, dozens of sketches were spread on the table there this morning. Big ones, little ones, all inscribed and decorated. And there was one of them. She paused, feeling herself teeter on the brink of a precipice, tingling in every nerve. To cover her dizzy fright, she turned away idly, reaching into the bowl again as she did so.
"Pray have a sweetmeat,"
invited Nahere with heavy irony. "Thank you," she forced a mocking grin, and her nerves quieted. She sauntered to a chair and sank down on its arm. It seemed to me that the inscription on this one vase looked less like decoration than a message.
A message?
He was on his feet and standing over her before she could draw breath, jerking her face up to him.
By Amun, you'll cease this babbling now and tell me what you mean.
I mean it was a message. She pulled free and sat down on the chair arm again. She felt quite cool now, and recklessly sure of herself. The tingling was gone. It was the name of a tavern. I'll wager it's where the rebels meet. Nahere stared at her a moment. Then he whirled, fetched a writing block and reed pen from a box, and beckoned her curtly.
Copy it here.
She took the block, swiftly sketched a vase, and began to draw hieroglyphs in a border around its lip. She could hear Nahere's heavy breathing as he leaned over her shoulder. Then a low sound, ugly with triumph, deep in his throat. He took the writing block, and he was smiling.
The Inn of the Falcon.
Nay, you have read it wrong, gasped Mara. In dismay, she stared at the hieroglyphs she had drawn, and though they blurred and swam with her fright, she could still make out that the last one was no falcon. You have read it wrong, she repeated, trying to steady her voice. It is an owl, master.
Aye, but you've set it down wrong, girl. That's the trouble. It was a natural error. No doubt you caught only a glimpse of the original, and it is easy to mistake the falcon symbol for the owl.
Nay, I saw it clearly. It was no glimpse. I took care to study it. He laughed almost amiably.
Then they, too, set it down wrong, perhaps by intention. Hi! Small good it did them. They meant the Inn of the Falcon. You may rely upon it. I know the place.
You know it? Said Mara faintly. The tingling was back. It had become a roar in her ears, as if she had stepped off the precipice and were falling sickeningly through space.
We've snared them now,
he was saying, half to himself.
So the pen is their messenger. Small wonder we've been puzzled. You did well to notice this. Aye, and I did well to buy you. But I'm seldom wrong. I know a clever slave when I see one. Come, choose a sweetmeat.
It seems hardly credible that a great lord like you would know aught of such an inn. I fancy it's a dirty den jammed with waterfront riffraff.
Oh, I've never set foot in the place. But I know of it. I know of it. Stay. I must think.
Mara drew a deep breath and bit into her sweetmeat. He knew. It was too late to wonder how. There he stood, rubbing his hands, thinking how he would use his knowledge. She had better help him think, and fast.
"You will set a spy to watch this place?" she began cautiously.
"Aye. It's their leader we want, not a rabble of underlings."
"It will be a hard choice, master."
"Hard?"
"To choose the spy you want."
"Nay, that's no problem. Stop chattering, girl, I must think."
Mara chose another sweetmeat and strolled a little closer. "The innkeeper's the problem. Have you thought of him? I know the breed, and I'll wager he misses little, especially this one, Osiris, with a plot hatching on the premises. He'll let no stranger by him, that's certain, as long as this leader is anywhere about. He'd throw out that scribe of yours in no time, even the Libyan. Master, no man could get past him."
Nahere was listening now.
His head had turned toward her.
Mara licked her fingers and flashed a glance at him.
"But I could," she added.
His chilly face did not change expression, but there was thoughtful calculation in the gaze that ran over her from head to toe.
"Could you indeed?"
he said. "Why don't you try me? I'm weary of the palace and the Canaanite. I can find the inn. I'm used to such places and used to talking my way in and out of them. I promise I'm a match for any innkeeper."
"What of the palace sentries?"
"I've made friends with a few of them already, just to pass the time."
"You need a taste of the whip, Miss Insolence. Who said you might thus make free with my orders?"
"You never forbade me, master. What harm in smiling at a sentry? I think one of them would let me out for a visit to that inn." Nahere sank into a chair and drummed his thin fingers on the arm of it.
"Nay, that's too chancy. Use my name. I've no doubt you know it by now."
"I, Lord Nahere," said Mara demurely. "Your fame is far too great in Thebes to—"
He silenced her with a gesture.
"Can you leave that princess of yours without her knowledge?"
"Easily."
He rose and strode to a chest in the corner, leaving Mara giddy with relief.
"Come here,"
he ordered.
He had unrolled a papyrus.
As she approached, she saw it was marked into squares and rectangles, like the rooms of a great house.
"This is a plan of the palace,"
he told her.
"Here is the guard room. Here is your own chamber, near this stair. Here are the king's apartments. And here..."
He jabbed a finger at a small square off one of the courtyards.
"Is a study reserved for my own use when I am at the Golden House. Do you think you could find it?"
Mara nodded. "Aye, down this passage and to the right. It would be the third door?"
"The fourth. Now look you."
He rolled up the papyrus and thrust it back into the chest.
"Go tomorrow night to the Inn of the Falcon. Go every night. You have only to give the sentry my name. I will send for you in 3 days, but if you learn aught before that, I want no delay in hearing of it. Go to my study at once if you have news. If I am not there, you will find someone who will bring you to me."
"I hope," remarked Mara, "that this someone drives better than your Libyan."
"It will be the Libyan."
He gave her an unpleasant smile.
"What you had best hope, impudent one, is that you can make good those boasts of yours."
"Did you not say yourself that I was clever?"
"Aye. Only take care you do not become too clever for your own good. Now go."
He jerked his head toward the door, and she went, trying to ignore his last remark. She was none too sure she had not already done that very thing. Still, she had won her gamble, she thought, as she joined Shadzar in the hall. The margin had been slimmer than she cared to think about, but she had satisfied the stony-faced one, saved her own neck, and saved Sheftu's too, by arranging her own appointment as the spy. Moreover, she no longer needed to worry about Reshed, who had grown increasingly unreasonable lately.
She could now walk past any sentry on the grounds by mentioning Nahiri's name. She had planned well. The only thing she had not planned was that Nahiri should ever know the real name of the inn. She followed Shadzar across a passageway. A servant flung open the door at its end and came hurrying toward them with a tray of empty plates. Attracted by the gust of music and laughter, Mara glanced into the room beyond him, caught a glimpse of blue-wigged ladies and courtiers grouped in a semicircle about a sumptuous table with great platters of fruit and a harpist playing, and just before the door swung shut, a figure darted into her range of vision, and there was a flash of golden balls. She stopped so suddenly that the hurrying servant almost crashed into her. He clutched frantically at his tray, and the Libyan pulled her on down the hall, muttering in annoyance. "Does your master always hire entertainers for his parties?" Mara asked him breathlessly.
"Would I know, impudent? He doesn't invite me to them, nor you either, I'll wager. Make haste. I've other things to do tonight than answer empty-headed questions."
Mara scarcely heard him. There were hundreds of jugglers in Thebes, of course. But if the one she had glimpsed was Sahure, then she was baffled no longer by her master's knowledge of the Inn of the Falcon. Sahure did hire himself out whenever a chance offered.
"I have seen high and low, princesses and slaves."
He was always boasting about it. Aye, it all fitted into a pattern that had almost ruined her gambling. Perhaps the ring had saved her once again. Thoughtfully, she stepped into the chariot and braced herself for the bruising ride home. Sahure had not seen her. That was a smile from the gods. So long as Lord Nahiri did not decide to visit the inn himself, all was still safe. But she was glad Sheftu knew nothing of what had happened tonight. She hoped he would never know how fast and loose she had played with the fate of Egypt and his king. Chapter 17. The Mark of Five. Ra, the sun god, had once more sailed his golden bark across the sky of Egypt. Over the high blue dome and into the west he had moved, as from time immemorial. Unhurried, serene, remote from the anxious scurryings of his white-clad worshippers below. He left darkness in his wake as he dropped behind the desert hills and began his night's slow journey through the land of the dead. Now, long hours passed as he sailed the dark river. At last he climbed into the east again, heralded by a rosy glow, bringing a burst of radiance as he crossed the horizon. Incense rose on the morning air from 1,000 altars. Cries of thanksgiving and entreaty came faintly to his ears, and the smoke of burned offerings assailed his nostrils. He was indifferent, aloof, rigid in his perfection. Wreathed in everlasting flames, he sailed slowly to his zenith and down his unchanging path once more into the west. It was half after the mark of four, and Lord Merab's party for the governor of Kush was at its height. At each end of the long reception hall stood tables loaded with refreshments, draped with flowers. Slaves hurried in and out among the beribboned columns, pouring wine, placing cones of scented ointment on the heads of guests, and replacing necklaces of lotuses with fresh ones. Two bands of musicians played alternately. Dancing girls whirled. Lord Sheftu stood beside a garland-hung column near the courtyard door, smiling serenely at the long-drawn hunting tale of His Excellency Pessior, Master of Granaries, and wishing him and his ever-wagging tongue at the end of the earth. A fool at best, Pessior was a cursed nuisance now, chattering away the precious moments. For Lord Sheftu to be seen at this reception had been important, for Sashai to escape, unnoticed, was becoming more vital every minute. A vision of the water clock formed in Sheftu's mind, with its level rising nearer and nearer the mark of five, when he must meet Jedet and the others in the City of the Dead.
Well told, friend Pessier, and bravely done. I can see your arm hurls a mighty spear. And now, if you will excuse me. But no, Pessier was off again, on desert lions this time, then veering to court gossip, without a pause for breath. Cheftu gazed across the room, his head aching from the heavy fragrance of wine and perfume, and from his own exasperation. The laughter of women tinkled about him. They lifted jeweled hands to sip their wine or held lotus blossoms to one another's nostrils with gestures of stilted grace, and occasionally cast lingering glances at young Lord Cheftu. The men strolled idly, stopping to exchange flatteries, gathering in little groups to mutter with their heads together, laughing at the antics of the pet gazelle which gambolled in the middle of the room with Lord Marab's naked children. And yonder, beyond the children, stood Count Hachepper, his handsome, leonine head bent in thought. Cheftu would have given his largest storehouse at that moment to know just what the Count was thinking. Was he brooding about those vineyards the architect had stolen from him? Or remembering the days of his youth, when he had been a commander of archers for the old pharaoh? Or reflecting on the plight of those same proud archers now, whose shrunken ranks and poor equipment Cheftu had only a few moments earlier been describing to him? I must find out, thought Cheftu. It is dangerous to leave it like this. Yet outside, the light was fading, the minutes stealing away. Osiris, would this chattering Pessier never leave off?
Most attentive to the Canaanite princess, have you not, Lord Cheftu?
Cheftu snapped alert.
I beg your pardon? Ah, now the truth, man.
Pessier's wig was slightly askew, his broad face flushed with delight at his own joke.
Tell me, is it the princess's embroidery that attracts you, or could it be the blue eyes of that little interpreter who goes with her everywhere?
Fortunately for Cheftu, there was no need to answer. Pessier was content with his own roar of laughter, and went on talking immediately.
Aye, you're not the first one, I'll wager, my friend, and it's certain you won't be the last. She's a well-favored little maid. Where the devil did they find her?
I believe, said Cheftu distantly, she joined the princess's suite at Abydos. Look yonder, my lord. They bring the mummy. A pair of slaves had appeared from the Hall of Pantries, carrying between them the wooden image of a mummy, rigid and deathlike in its painted wrappings. Other slaves, bearing huge garlanded bowls of wine, followed the displayers of the rigid one. According to custom, the procession began a circuit of the room, chanting, "Gaze here, drink and be merry. When you die, such will you be," amid loud laughter and cries of thirst from the guests. Even Pessier surged after the wine carriers, cup aloft, and Cheftu seized the moment. He walked swiftly around the other end of the room, where Count Hachepper was already moving toward him. They met in a half-concealed alcove near one of the refreshment tables. The Count was a large, shaggy-browed, handsome man of middle age, and he at once came gruffly to the point.
"I have been thinking of what you told me, Lord Cheftu. Can you swear to its truth?"
"Sacred Ma'at herself would swear to it, Excellency.
The troops were in sorry plight, half the archers bareheaded, and none of them paid. And the regular army is worse yet. Should our enemies choose to attack us some fine morning, Egypt would be defenseless."
"Monstrous," muttered the other.
"I knew not of it."
"Her Radiance and Count Senmet keep these things a closely guarded secret."
"That scurvy architect. Yet he is her favorite."
"I have reason to believe his situation is far from stable at the moment. I took a hand in this matter of the bodyguard."
"Good," grunted the Count. "If we could be rid of him..."
"Excellency, think further. Would her next favorite be any different?"
Cheftu brought his lips close to the other's ear, dropped his voice to a mere breath. "Egypt must be rid of her, too." Hachepper's heavy brows drew hard together. In a voice equally low, he muttered, "You speak treason, my lord."
"Is it treason to oust thieves, to rid Egypt of enemies?"
"I am not alone, Excellence.
Behind me stands an army, nobles, priests, common folk, as well as armed soldiers, waiting only my signal. Your future lies with us, not with Hatshepsut, and the time is near."
Haheper moistened his lips, flashed a look at Sheftu.
"Nobles," he murmured, "aye, nobles in plenty, those who love Egypt and know which barrel holds the fish."
The count was silent. He seemed scarcely to breathe. After a long pause, he murmured,
"I am a wealthy man, Lord Sheftu."
"You could be wealthier."
Again Sheftu waited, knowing the crucial moment had come.
"How much?" said Haheper softly.
"By half again."
The heavy brows shot up, and Sheftu straightened, smiling to himself. Another great one had found his price. The count drew a long breath and met his eyes.
"I, too, love Egypt. You have my full support against those who prey on her. When you need me, call. And may the gods smile on our cause."
Turning abruptly, he walked away across the room. Sheftu's satisfaction was not unmixed with irony. It was surprisingly easy, he reflected, to promise a fortune one had not yet got one's hands on. Getting it was going to be a different matter. Yet get it he must. He had made half a dozen such promises on the strength of his plans for tonight. And this one had made him late. A moment later, he slipped out the courtyard door unnoticed and raced for his chariot. It was well past the mark of five, and dusk was gathering over the city of the dead. From the low, palm-thatched buildings, workers were emerging, stone-cutters powdered with granite dust, embalmers bent with weariness and smelling of natron and spices, yawning glassmakers, scroll copyists rubbing their eyes, gold artisans, weavers, potters, carpenters, jewelers. Singly and in groups, they trickled out of the workshops to the streets to form a homeward-bound stream which branched in every direction, east toward the Nile and its waiting ferries, north and south and west to scattered cottages among the fields. In the lee of a deserted carpenter's shop, one small group lingered, casting anxious glances now and then toward the distant palace and the clusters of trees and white walls which marked the villas surrounding it. Two of the men wore the garments of Neochori, servants of the temple. The third was a burly priest, calm and imposing of mien, of obvious importance. Beside them stood a donkey laden with two huge baskets.
"It is a bad omen that he is late,"
muttered the smaller of the two Neochori.
"A bad omen."
"Think you he is late on purpose?" whispered the other indignantly. "I'll hear no ill spoken of Sashai."
"I spoke none, friend Kaimouse. Perhaps he failed to receive the message."
"Nay, he had it," the priest broke in.
Once more, they fell to scanning the crowd in anxious silence. Suddenly, a figure in the long robe of a lesser priest moved along the shadow of the next building, and in a moment was beside them, breathing heavily.
"I could not come sooner. Let us start at once. We have a long way to go."
Without further talk, the four struck out westward through the crooked streets, past the mud dwellings and the fields, and out across the broad stretch of desert that lay beyond. Their white garments turned pink with the sunset as they moved nearer and nearer the dark blue shadow of the western cliffs, and finally they were swallowed, one by one, by a defile in the face of the rock. The stones of the steep, narrow path pressed sharp through Sheftu's palm-leaf sandals, and he sweated with nervousness under his priest's heavy wig and tent-like cloak. Ahead trod Jedet, his broad back solid and his head erect. Sheftu thanked the gods for that stoic figure. His own composure had been sorely tried by the venture's inauspicious start, his tardiness, the frantic rush to the meeting place, and the disturbing memory of a certain remark of Pessier's. He felt confused and harried. But he could rely on Jeddet, and on the diggers, too, he thought. Loyal Kaimouse and Usur the Weaver, both good men. He cast an anxious glance over his shoulder at the donkey. Its great side baskets hung heavy, laden with stones under a top layer of innocent funerary offerings. It was well, they must hang heavy indeed now, if they were to appear almost empty when coming out. When coming out? Would they really be coming out a few hours hence, with their mission accomplished and the baskets loaded with inestimable treasure? It was too far ahead to think of. Best wonder whether they could even get in. Sharp-eyed guards waited up ahead at the entrance. The Valley of the Tombs was the most jealously watched area of land in all Egypt. Nay, do not wonder about any of it, Sheftu counseled himself. Keep cool. Deal with each thing as it comes. But as he pushed the large worries to the back of his mind, Pessior's jibe about Mara came again to dance like a mocking heft at the front of it. Was it so obvious, then, that Lord Sheftu was taking a peculiar interest in the Canaanite princess? It was too bad those few casual meetings had been noticed. Worse, even dangerous, that Mara had been singled out as the real object of them. Worst of all, for Lord Sheftu's pride, was the fact that his own powerful but secret attraction to those lotus-blue eyes was apparently no secret at all, but plain enough for even a fool like Pessior to notice and comment on. Was he as transparent as a schoolboy in the first stages of puppy love? It was humiliating. However, if the court gossips thought him merely smitten with a pretty maid, perhaps they would inquire no further into his motives. Perhaps. The path turned and twisted, winding upward through the cleft in the hills. At last, the palm-thatched hut of the guard station showed ahead in the dusk. Jeddet turned to smile at Sheftu. His moon face was pale and set, but his voice steady. The delay did not matter. It is the right hour, my friend. We planned well. Aye. Sheftu returned the smile with stiff lips, then murmured to the diggers, Speak no word, remember. Gravely, the little procession moved out onto the barren hilltop toward the hut. A guard appeared at the doorway, then stepped out, followed by another. But thanks to Jeddet's careful planning, they carried no torches, for it was not yet full dark. Sheftu was profoundly grateful for the semi-gloom when the guards came forward to peer into their faces.
You have permits to enter here?
One asked gruffly. Jeddet advanced a step, his bulk imposing, his carriage haughty.
My good man, I am Jeddet, priest of the Semrank and second official of the necropolis. I need no permit. Now hearken. Have you seen or heard aught suspicious in the valley the past 2 days?
Suspicious? No, Excellence.
The first guard's tone had become more respectful, but the second was staring at Jeddet closely, and did not add the excellence.
You mean robbers?
He demanded.
I will ask the questions,
said Jeddet coldly.
There has been a report that the tomb of His Majesty the First Thutmose has been disturbed. What do you know of it?
Nothing, Your Holiness, gasped the first guard. I swear by the feather of Maat, the truthful one, there has been not a—
The report is false, grunted the other.
Jeddet favored him with an icy stare.
I trust you are right, but naturally I must find out for myself. Kindly stand aside.
He started forward, but the second guard stayed where he was, his gaze flicking to Sheftu, then to the two diggers, and finally to the laden donkey.
What have you in the baskets?
He demanded. Sheftu could only thank the gods for Jeddet's convincing air of mild exasperation.
Funerary offerings, of course, said the priest. Would we come empty-handed to the Great One's resting place?
The guard's heavy face did not change expression as he moved out of Jeddet's path and sauntered back to the donkey. With a tremendous effort, Sheftu refrained from watching him, affecting an attitude of stolid indifference. But his very spine tingled as he heard the creak of a basket lid being raised. It might be merely a routine check, but if the guard had even the glimmer of a real suspicion, he would push aside the offerings and see those stones beneath. The lid of the basket dropped. Legs trembling with relief, Sheftu moved forward at Jedet's nod, only half hearing the first guard's apologies. They had filed past the hut and actually started down the path into the valley when, behind them, the second guard spoke again.
"Stay!"
Once more they halted, but this time Jedet's burly back was quivering perceptibly. Sheftu, by contrast, felt a wave of anger sweep aside all the confusion that had been hampering him. Suddenly cool and bold, he grasped Jedet's arm reassuringly under the concealing cloak and faced the guard.
"You show little respect to His Holiness, fellow. What is it this time? And mind you, address him properly."
"I mean no disrespect, Excellence,"
muttered the guard. "But I have my orders, and I'm to let no one pass without a permit. Since you have none, I will have to go with you."
There was an instant's appalled silence. Then Jedet found his voice jerkily.
"Your devotion to duty is commendable. However, there is no need for you to leave your post. My comrade can stay at the post," interrupted the guard stubbornly. "It's my duty to go with you."
Sheftu thought fast. Further argument would give them away completely. Even the first guard was beginning to look doubtful now. With a warning pressure on the priest's arm, Sheftu said carelessly,
"As you wish."
He could feel Jedet go rigid, but an instant later the priest shrugged and started down the path again as if indifferent to the whole thing. The guard fell in beside him, somewhat sheepishly, to the accompaniment of his comrade's relieved jeer.
"Aye, suspicious one. It's a long tramp you'll have for nothing. Until tomorrow, then."
"Tomorrow," remarked Sheftu, as they wound downward through the rocks.
"Will your friend not be waiting when we return?" "Nay, our duty is over in half an hour,"
rumbled the guard, amiable enough now that he had got his way.
"Other men watch through the night."
Sheftu allowed himself a moment's grim admiration of the fellow in front of him, plodding along, half embarrassed, but still doggedly doing his duty. If there were more like him, the valley would be well guarded. Unfortunately, there would be one less before the night was done. The last glow of sunset was almost gone when the little procession reached the valley's floor and started out across it. Nuit, the Starry One, had stretched her dark and spangled body across the heavens, shedding a faint glitter over a vast, rugged wasteland of craggy buttes and sand and rocks, completely bare of vegetation. Eroded, sharp-peaked hills and giant boulders loomed here and there, strange-shaped, like sleeping monsters, still breathing heat from their sun-baked sides into the cool night air. There was profound, unnatural stillness. Sheftu trod warily, his eyes fixed on the glimmer of the guard's cloak ahead, his ears straining for some sound other than the whisper of the donkey's hoofs on the sand. But in all that desolation, no bird called, no small creature scampered. Nothing stirred, nothing lived, except themselves. In and out among the crags they moved, deeper and deeper, into the valley's heart. At last, Jedet turned aside into a gully which sloped downward between tumbled piles of rock. He was picking his way slowly, waiting, in an agony of suspense, Sheftu knew, for some signal as to the guard. They were very near their destination now. Sheftu set his jaw, drawing both hands in through the slits in his cloak. When they emerged again, they brought his long, stout-woven sash. Stealthily, he closed the distance between himself and the guard. Grasping an end of the sash in each hand, he crossed his wrists. "Now," whispered a voice inside him. One swift movement, and the sash fell about the guard's neck. Sheftu snapped it tight, at the same time jamming his knee into the small of the man's back. Next instant, both had pitched forward to tumble over the rocky ground, Sheftu clinging to his writhing, thrashing victim, and still tightening the garrote. There was a scramble of footsteps, grunted curses as the diggers flung themselves upon the guard's flailing arms and legs. A moment later, they had him pinioned, and Sheftu's muscles knotted for the last strangling jerk. Knotted, but never released their energy. Slowly, Sheftu relaxed, and as the diggers glanced up in astonishment, he flipped the sash free and used it instead as a gag. Knotting it securely, he stood up.
"You mean to spare him?"
whispered Jedet. In the starlight, the priest's face showed pasty white and sweating.
"Osiris, what will we do with him?"
"Nothing for the present,"
muttered Sheftu.
"Take his sash, you men, and tie him well."
He turned his back and walked over to Jedet. He knew he had been a fool to let the fellow live, but he had no stomach for murdering a man whose only crime was stubbornness. It was possible this other plan might work.
"He'll be safe enough here, Jedet."
"But later, when we return to Thebes?"
came the priest's frantic whisper.
"He will return with us. Nekonk can spirit him away downriver with the others, and keep him hidden until it's safe to free him."
"What are you saying, my lord? It's the guards at the valley entrance I'm thinking of, the new ones who come on duty with the night. We shall have to explain our baskets all over again. Amun, help us. Can we also carry their comrade past them, bound and gagged?"
"He will not be bound. He will walk among us, but with my knife at his back. He will say only what I—"
There was a sharp cry behind them. Sheftu whirled, just in time to see Kaimaus doubled up, groaning. The guard's tunic rip in Usur's clutching hands, and the guard himself dart up the path, free and tearing at his gag. With a curse, Sheftu sprang after him. The guard was stumbling on the treacherous rocks, staggering a little, but he had the gag off now. Sheftu wrenched his dagger from its sheath.
"Thieves! Thieves! Help in the valley! Thieves!"
The cry rang out hideously, echoing off the sides of the cleft. But the guard had not strength enough left to both run and shout. With the last "thieves," he staggered into a boulder, saw Sheftu close behind him, and drew his short sword. It clashed once against Sheftu's knife, was deflected by a desperate wrench, freed itself, swung up murderously, then fell clattering to the ground as Sheftu's dagger drove home.
"My friend, you die for Egypt,"
gasped Sheftu. He caught the crumpling body and eased it down beside the boulder. Usur was beside him, and an instant later, Jedet.
"Master, I could not help it,"
panted the digger.
"I was trying to loose his sash, and he kicked Kaimaus as a mule kicks, as a horse kicks."
"Be silent."
Sheftu leaned against the boulder, struggling to catch his breath, straining his ears for any sign that the guard's cries had been heard. All was silent, except for the crunching of pebbles as Kaimaus plodded up the path toward them. Wearily, Sheftu leaned over the guard and retrieved his dagger.
"Carry him back, and put him across the donkey. Get a torch burning, one of you men."
A few minutes later, they were making their way by flickering torchlight down the gully, the donkey with its grim burden following behind along the rocky path. On either side, the barren rock rose higher into darkness. The way wound more steeply down. How much farther? Already the Nile and Thebes seemed leagues away. Sheftu nearly bumped into the priest, who had come to a sudden halt and was pointing.
"Ast, we have arrived."
Slowly, Sheftu extended the torch. There, ahead, against the side of the gully, leaned a pile of red granite boulders, the same which had haunted him for 4 interminable days. With an effort, he dragged his eyes away from it.
"There is the place,"
he told the diggers.
"Beneath the rubble at the left is the door we seek. Dig until you find it."
Chapter 18. By the Dark River. It was an hour before the clang of shovels ceased. Sheftu, sitting on a rock some yards away, was aware of eerie silence and raised his head. The torch flared wild and lonely against the night, revealing a gap in the rubble and a stone stairway leading downward into obscurity. At the top stood Jedet and the sweating diggers, their eyes upon him. Slowly he rose and walked across the sands, taking the torch from the priest. At the bottom of the steps was a plastered-over door, imprinted with the royal seal of the necropolis and the cartouche of the first Thutmose. A tremor passed through Sheftu at sight of the familiar hieroglyphs of the old king's name, enclosed in their oval line. He and the prince had stood on this spot long ago, on the day of the entombment, to see that seal pressed into the wet plaster. His lips parted, but it was moments before he could force himself to speak. "Thy prince has no right to demand such a crime." "Open it," he said. The diggers crept past him, down the steps. Under their chisels, the plaster crumbled in an irregular crack, gradually outlining the door. At his elbow, Jedet was whispering, "Anubis, strike us not. We have plaster to mend it. We bear the royal seal. All shall be as it was when we have gone." Sheftu found it hard to breathe. The portal, which was to have remained closed and inviolate for 3,000 years, was swinging open before him, with a creak that woke echoes far back in the depths of the tomb. A breath of stale, dry air drifted out and enveloped him. Slowly, every step an act of will, he descended the stairs and passed through the door into the habitation of the dead. He stood in a tiny entry where the stone floor was strewn with flowers. He remembered them, the last offerings of the funeral party returning to the upper world. They looked only a little withered, as if no more than a week had passed since they were dropped here. But when he touched one with his toe, it fell into dust so fine there was no trace left. Shivering a little, he raised the torch. Pleading texts from the Book of the Dead leaped at him from the close carven walls. "I have not committed iniquity against men. I have not oppressed the poor. I have not starved any man. I have not made any to weep. I have not committed that which is an abomination to the gods. I have not turned back the water in its season. I have not put out the fire in its time. Since I know the names of the gods who are with thee in the hall of double truth, save thou me from them, Osiris. I am pure. I am pure. I am pure. I am pure." Before Sheftu, another flight of steps led downward into darkness. With Jedet pressing at his side and the diggers with their baskets crowding at his heels, he started the long descent. Down, down, down they crept, into night so black the torch was but a moving spark, into silence so deep the ears rang with it. Staler and more oppressive grew the air, the same air left here years ago when the outer door was shut and sealed. Was there enough for 4 men breathing hard with fear? Sweat masked Sheftu's face only to evaporate instantly in the shriveling dryness of the place, drawing his skin and stiffening his lips. In vain, he tried to keep his mind away from the thought of the millions of tons of rock and earth above them. The deeper they went, the more ponderous grew the weight, the more stifling his awareness of it. The steps ended at last, in the depths of the earth. The men stopped a moment, hearing their own breathing loud in the silence. All were loath to leave the stair, which now seemed known and safe. Sheftu's thoughts flashed back to the guard, lying so still under the stars far above them, and to the guard's comrades at the valley entrance, who might be starting to search for him, wondering why he had not returned. A sense of urgency possessed Sheftu. They must hasten, or the alarm would be raised and they'd crawl out at last into a trap. Fighting his reluctance, he led the way out across a stony floor. 1 pace, then another, then a third, with the light flickering into the black void. Suddenly, A vivid figure twice the height of a man sprang out of the gloom. The trespassers recoiled as at a blow, and a sound that was half grunt, half moan, broke from the digger Usur. It was some seconds before Sheftu could bring himself to raise the torch and discover that the terrifying figure was one of a procession painted along the walls of what appeared to be a lofty and spacious corridor. Sheftu forced himself to steadiness, to memory of this corridor from the day of the old king's entombment. Then, gripping the torch, he started down the long hall. More and more brilliantly painted figures slid past them in the wavering light. A group of women bent in mourning, with disheveled hair. Slaves bearing treasure boxes and furniture. Dignitaries pacing behind a canopied sledge on which rested a great sarcophagus. It was the old pharaoh's funeral procession, depicted faithfully in every detail, climaxed at the far end of the hall by the last solemn ritual of the opening of the mouth. There, framing the door, rose the painted figure of a Sem priest with his mystic tool, while opposite him the jackal-headed god Anubis supported the mummy. Jedet began to chant in a low, unsteady monotone.
In peace, unto the great god. Proceed in peace, unto thy tomb in the necropolis. In peace, unto the land of the west and thy dwelling on the dark Nile.
His voice sounded thin and strange in the heavy stillness. The torch and its huddled bearers moved between the towering figures and under the lintel of the door. Before them lay more stairs, leading down, always downward and inward, into darker mystery, thicker silence.
In peace.
The priest's voice was a thread of sound, now muffled against the narrow sides of the stair, now hollow and unreal across a passage, rippling as the torchlight rippled along the carven walls. It was as if he could not stop, though the monotony of it beat